Well, if you recall from last week, we were looking at the second journey of Paul, and we got up to Philippi. We took a little detour, but we're back on the road again today. And if you are looking there at chapter 17, I'm going to just hurriedly summarize a few of the beginning verses to bring us up to the point that I want to slow down at today. This chapter tells us that Paul and his company of Silas and Timothy left Philippi. They probably left Luke there, as we can best we can tell. And then they moved on about 100 miles along that same Via Ignatia roadway to Thessalonica. When they got there, they had a good reception of many that believed, but they also had a lot of resistance from the Jews. And so the Jews, stirring up trouble, basically forced them to leave. And they headed off that main road about 45 miles down to Berea. Another couple of days' journey. When they got there, again, they had a good reception, perhaps even better than Thessalonica. Many became believers. But the Jews from Thessalonica were hard on their heels. They dogged them all the way and stirred up trouble there in Berea. So at that point, Paul was sent off. He was taken by perhaps some of those new believers off to a boat a few miles over to the shore, leaving Silas and Timothy back in that area, from what we can tell, probably to minister to both Berea and Thessalonica over the next few weeks. Paul got in a boat with a couple of the helpers, the attendants, and they took off along the way toward the lower end of Greece. So you can see the little path there that I just described from Thessalonica to Berea, then out on the Aegean Sea, down the coast, and winding their way around. They would have gone around the southern tip or southern end of that peninsula of what's called Achaia, that area in green. That's the Roman province. It's the Roman name that was given to southern Greece when Rome came in and took over the territory. But the port was around on the on that other side there, and that would be where he landed. One thing to notice in those verses, though, in Thessalonica, is a good point to recognize about just kind of where things were in terms of the missionary activities that were going on, is in verse 6. And if you'll notice there in verse 6 that the Jews that came and accused them in Thessalonica said that referred to them as these that have turned the world upside down and are come hither also. That term world is a term that really represents the civilized land of the time, which for them was the Roman Empire. So it was like saying they've gone out there and they've turned the Roman Empire upside down, and now they've come here. So that's the kind of impact that Paul and his companions had, the impression they made, the reputation that they had by this time. They had had quite an influence in the areas that they had gone and quite a broad knowledge of people far and wide. As they came into the little boat that Paul was on with his attendants arrived there on the coast that I showed you on the map there, they would have come into this port, the port of Piraeus. And this particular port was the major place from ancient times that the Greeks had their navy. So you can imagine that being filled with all the Greek fleet at one time, many years in the past. And at this time, however, things had changed quite a bit. The Romans had taken over. They had defeated the Greeks in 86 BC, which was over 100 years prior to when Paul arrived. And when they did, they conquering the city, they breached the walls, and they tore down, destroyed, and burned almost the whole city. So it was only slowly being rebuilt at this time. It was nothing like what it used to be. Paul would have arrived here alone. In fact, he tells us in a letter that he wrote a few months later to the Thessalonians when he finally ends up in Corinth, that he He refers to this as a time when a point of particular significance in his life, that he was left alone in Athens. So it made an impression on him that he was there alone. This was unusual for Paul. He was usually with companions. He usually had people around him, and he depended on them a lot. And that group made a big difference in his ministry activity. Sometimes his life depended on it. So here he was. He stepped off the boat. His attendants left. They took the boat and left. And he was on this dock. You can imagine being there with buildings all up in front of him. He could hardly even see ahead of him as he walked along the dock. He went along and found this big opening between the buildings, and it led to a road. And you can see that in the picture here. That road led to Athens. It was a wide road, and just as he got on the road, over to the right, he would have seen what was left of a big temple of Zeus. And as he entered that area, he would have seen these walls on both sides. They were part of the ancient fortress of Athens, mostly torn down, destroyed by the Romans. The remains of them were there. It was about a 2-mile stretch of just straight line. And once he got into that, he could begin to see far in the distance the hill, the Acropolis of Athens. That's where he was headed. So he would have walked along that road. And as he did, he would have noticed something on both sides of the road. He would have noticed one after the other and after the other and after the other of shrines and statues and altars to the pagan gods that they worshipped. He would have seen each one in different states of weathering and wear and disrepair, but he would have walked along hundreds of these during that time, probably reading the inscriptions as he went along, like someone going through a museum and just noting these. It was overwhelming to him. As he got to the end of this path, he would have broken out into the view of the city. He would come out of that narrow path and seen for the first time what the city looked like. The city at that time was not quite what it looks like in this picture. The Romans had begun to build some of it back over the years. It was not back to the glory of the classic Greek times, but they'd started to, the emperors on occasion would become interested in Athens, and they would take an interest in certain buildings, certain temples, and so forth. And so some of this had started to be reconstructed. But imagine it not quite to this glory when Paul walked through, not quite to this level of restoration. And so he would have seen much of what the city looked like at that time. As he went through that, he would have noticed a number of things about it. And one is that he would have soon passed a temple to Zeus. Now, this temple was originally started hundreds of years before by the Greeks, but they never finished it. Then it was at least partially destroyed by the Romans when they came in, and then the Romans took an interest and they started to build it back. So in some state of disrepair, Paul would have seen it. A temple that was intended by the Greeks symbolically to be the greatest, grandest temple in all the world. They'd put that much into it. And so when he saw this among all the other altars and shrines, you can imagine that he finally got to the point of making this comment, that his spirit was so stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. But this wasn't the half of it. There's more to come. In fact, the city had reached a point with the Romans having come in that even the population was lower. It's probably no more than about 20, 25,000 people at this time. But it had so many idols that the one Roman author named Petronius said it was so full of deities that you may more frequently meet with a god than a man. Well, when Paul came into the city, there would have been not only the idols and the temples, but there were also hero cults and there were mystery religions. There were all sorts of pagan religions that were involved at this time. Now, Paul had seen a lot of idols and pagan religions and so forth, but you can really get the impression here that he was really overwhelmed with what he saw in Athens. And just to give you a quick view of some of those, I'm going to take you through just a few slides that show you the types of things he would have seen one after the other. He would have passed a sanctuary of Dionysius, which was in the theater. This was dedicated to the god of wine and frivolity. Then he would have passed a long stoa along the southern edge of that Acropolis, that big stone hill. And that stoa, which was sort of a covered colonnade, would have led to the Asclepion, which was the hospital of the city. It was dedicated to Asclepios, the god of healing. So anyone that came to the hospital depended on Asclepios for healing. And then finally, he would have come around the southern end of the Acropolis. And as he did, he would find some steps, some stone steps, not more than maybe 5 or 6 feet wide. And he would have found those to climb up and get make his way up to this 500-foot tall hill. This is what it looks like today. And at that time, when Paul came through, it would have looked more like this. And you can see on the western side that we're looking at that there would be a pathway from steps and paths that wound around and came up to the top of the western end of that Acropolis. As he approached that first corner where the foundation has a tall wall, he would look up high, and on the top of that would be the temple of Athena and Nike, Nike being the goddess of victory and strength. And then he would have walked along the path toward the center where the main entrance, that colonnaded entrance, is. And he would have come up that entrance in order to enter the Acropolis, which was their place of all the collection of their various gods and dedicated to Athena. As he approached that entrance, it looks more like this today. These steps might be the ones that Paul climbed as he approached that entryway and that colonnaded opening. At that time, it probably looked more like this, a huge grand entrance with large marble columns that led in and drew your attention in to all the temples that were inside. And each one had a significance to the Athenians. As he just got through the post and the columns here and looked in, first thing he would have seen was a giant bronze statue of Athena. And she was dressed as a warrior with a shield and a spear in her hands. Just to the right side as he went in, he would have seen a large structure called the Erechtheion, which contained a large wooden statue of Athena and a number of other gods, including ones like Poseidon, the god of the sea, and lots of others. And then over to the right side, the major structure of the Acropolis was the Parthenon. It was a large temple with marble columns that went all the way around. And this was also adorned at the top with a pediment, and in it was carved all the gods in their symbolizing their conflict at the birth of Athena and all the different things that were part of the Greek culture story and story of the gods. Inside was a large sanctuary cavity, which was very typical of these large temples. In this one, this is called a cella, which is that large inner sanctuary. It had a 40-foot statue of Athena, which was made from gold and ivory. And just behind the Parthenon was a temple to Augustus, because he's the one who was responsible for much of the restoration in the first century of this at the time that Paul was there. So that was all part of what Paul would have seen. And you can imagine now why he came to the conclusion that this place is just full of idols. And it was the very epitome of the culture of the time, the people of the time, because this city was the keeper of all of that classical knowledge and understanding of the gods. They were responsible for maintaining that whole culture. Well, just to the northwest of the Acropolis was the Agora. Now, the Agora was a place of both a market and also a place of business or government activity. It was restored in a large measure by the time Paul came there in the middle of the first century by the Romans, and so it represented a lot of their influence and their government and their structure. But it preserved much of what was there from the Greeks, because the Romans allowed Athens to be a free city-state, but they still had a strong authoritarian control over it. So you can imagine, as he walked through the city, he saw what was the remains of a great, powerful, proud culture, but he also saw Roman soldiers, and he saw the influence of the Roman occupation of the place. And many of the fortified walls were not rebuilt. Only slowly was Rome taking an interest that they had in the Greek culture and adopting it to themselves, that they began to rebuild these things in their own way. And the Agora was part of that. So the Agora, as it might have looked in Roman times, had a number of structures that the Romans had constructed, and had the marketplace with a lot of busy commercial activity. It also had government offices and the governance of the city and places where people would be involved in that sort of activity. It was there that the text tells us in verse 17, as we're just kind of moving along in the story, that was the place where Paul came, and it says, therefore he disputed in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. So this is the market. This is the place of the market where he would have met. And in this particular place were also many gods and altars and shrines. There was a temple of Ares. There was a temple of Zeus. There was a temple of Apollo. There was the Hellenistic temple. There was an altar to 12 gods that represented the 12 principal gods of the Greeks. There was another altar to Zeus, and there were a couple of stoas that you can see in the picture of these colonnaded areas, and they were dedicated to gods. It was probably in one of those stoas that Paul came, as the people came and went through the marketplace, that he came and preached. And so the text tells us in verse 18, if you're following along there, that then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and the Stoics encountered him, and some said, "What will this babbler say?" Others, he seemed to be a setter forth of or proclaimer of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. Now it mentions two types of philosophers. These were the two most prominent philosophers from the ancient Greek times. The Epicureans are probably the ones who referred to him as a babbler. They were the ones who believed that there was no way to reason your way to truth, so they chose a path of experience through pleasure. And they were probably just heard him as just a bunch of babble. In fact, the term that's sometimes used to translate this word is scavenger of tidbits. Literally, this word spermologos means a seed picker. And it's probably a term that these philosophers adopted from watching the little birds out on the street in the agora, their little heads bobbing around randomly and picking up seeds. And that was the image they had here. Some worthless, unlearned person that was just collecting little scraps of knowledge bit by bit and then retelling it at his own gain or fortune. And so then it says that there were some called the Stoics, who were those who were meticulous in their self-sufficiency and their self-control. And they perhaps were the ones who said, "He seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities, preaching Jesus and the resurrection." And many believe that because Paul so inseparably connected these two, and they were so confused in their understanding and trying to reason it out, that they took these two things to both be deities, Jesus and the resurrection, and one must be a god and one must be a goddess. They were really confused on what these strange things were that Paul was telling them. It was totally inconsistent with their notion of their ancient cosmic family of the gods. And it was a man-centered religion. This is always what you see with the pagan religions, is that they're man-centered. Paul was trying to explain, proclaim something that was God-centered, and that was where the confusion really was. And so we come to the next verses that you see there, and if we read those, we find that it says that, and they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine thereof thou speakest is, for thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know, therefore, what these things mean. Now, that term Areopagus actually has a definite article in front of it that's not translated, so it's really the Areopagus. And this is really a 12-judge council that they're referring to. The Areopagus was really the court of Areopagus. It was sort of the supreme court of the civil and religious matters that under the Romans they had still had the authority to administrate. And so anything that involved religion, a new religion, a permit to go out and preach or to speak, anything that involved that had to be approved by this council. It had to be reviewed and understood and accepted for approval. And so even though we find in verse 21 that Luke does mention in parentheses that a lot of the people that were here to hear him were just there for entertainment. They were just there to get their ears bent. They just like to hear new things. But these philosophers had another vested interest. They had the responsibility of judging and deciding about these things that Paul was saying that they didn't understand. And so they wanted to present him to the council. So we don't know when this happened. It may have been the same day. It may have been the next morning. But they arranged a hearing with the council. The council met at a particular place. And so with some apprehension, perhaps, but recognizing an opportunity, Paul was thinking about going before this council. Well, the council met on a hill that was just to the west of the Acropolis. It was not quite as high, about 370 feet, just a big outcropping of rock with a level place on the top of it. And at that time, there was probably a stoa, perhaps with a covering and some columns and kind of a nice place where the council would meet that was on this outcropping. And on that, this place is referred to in verse 22 as Mars Hill. Well, actually, to the Greeks, it was Ares Hill. It was dedicated to the Greek god Ares. The Romans called that god of war Mars. And so that's where that name comes from. But in the Greek, literally, it's Areos Pagos is the term, which happens to be the same name that we transliterate into Areopagus, which was the name of the council that met there. So that's where those words come from. And on this particular day, perhaps in the morning, it was early in the morning. You can imagine the east sun creating a shadow and this place being kind of in the shade under the shadow of the Acropolis that stood high up before it as Paul met there with them. So they came before this place and Paul had an opportunity to speak. And so we find in these verses that come next that he challenged the worldview of the Athenians, but he did so in a very interesting way in which he reasoned with them about something of the unknown. And it says there in verse 22 and 23, then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious, or meaning they were very religious. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, or that is your objects of worship, I found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. Well, probably Paul saw this altar to the unknown God in that long array of altars along the path. It's called the Road of the Long Walls that I showed you in an earlier slide. Probably he saw that there and noticed it. That probably struck his eye as he was going through, and that's what he where he started and what he brought up at this time. So to help you understand a little better, let me tell you a little story from a time bringing you up to date on times of the past and see the background here. There's a story that's told. It's actually recorded a number of sources. One in particular was from a 3rd century AD Greek biographer named Diogenes Laertius. And he recorded many of the details. There were some other sources that also added to it. And I want to just relate the story in a way that sort of pulls some of those details together from the various sources. There was back around 600 BC in Athens a plague. It was a terrible plague. It killed about a fourth of the population, and no one could figure out what to do. They went around and they prayed to all of their gods. They tried desperately to find a way to get relief. Finally, one of the oracles, a priestess, suggested that they should go to a man named Epimenides. He was a well-known philosopher, but he was also known to be loved by the gods. He lived on the island of Crete, so they decided to send a boat to go and get him and bring him back. And so that's what they did. And Epimenides came back, landed there, probably at that same port where Paul was, walked up that long road that Paul walked, and came into Athens. And when he got to the end, and they questioned him about what to do about the plague, he said, "I think your problem is that you have disturbed one of the gods, and that you've not appeased one of the gods, and it's a god that you're ignorant of." And he said, "This is what you should do." So he had the people go and get a lot of sheep, black sheep and white sheep, different kinds of sheep. And he had them take them all up to the Areopagus. And they took them up to that place, and he said, "Let them out in that place and watch them graze." And then they were to pray to the gods, particularly this one god that they didn't know, and ask that that God have mercy on them in their ignorance and forgive them. And when the sheep went out to graze, that the sheep that would be an acceptable sacrifice would lie down and not graze. And those are the ones they would sacrifice. Well, they did this, and they marked the spot where a sheep lay that was not grazing, and they sacrificed that sheep. And then they had masons come in and build altars later, and built an altar in every spot and a number of other places in the city. And they labeled these Agnostis Theos, which means the unknown God. Then the plague, after a time, was abated. Many years passed, and an Athenian came along and happened to see these old altars and remembered the story of Epimenides. And he thought, well, maybe I should go and restore these altars as a testimony to this unknown God. This happens to be one of the altars that was found actually in Rome of a similar type. But when this Athenian went along to find them, he found that most of them were so weathered and damaged from the years of time and neglect by the Athenians that he could only find one that was suitable to restore. And so he restored that one, and it's thought that very likely that's the one that was on the road leading into Athens that Paul saw. And so Paul saw this altar of the unknown God, and he recognized that this was a way that he could explain who the true God was. We don't know how he learned of this, but probably through some early teaching. And he used this in his sermon. In fact, we can see in verse 28 that he actually quoted a line of Epimenides from one of his poems. But the real verse that drives it home is verse 26. And if you look at verse 26, you'll see that it says, "And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of that of their habitation." And from that, we see that Paul recognized that God never wastes a moment in human history. He was explaining to them from something they would have recognized. They were sitting on the very spot where this tale of Epimenides took place. They certainly would have remembered it. And he even included a line of a poem from him to make sure that they understood this is what he was referring to when he referred to their ignorance about the unknown God. And so from that, we see that God had appointed a time hundreds of years before for a plague to come, for some altars to be constructed to an unknown God. And now the Athenians were appointed to live in this spot at this time and have the answer right under their noses. And so Paul was explaining to them that God had come and brought a sacrifice. But it wasn't the sacrifices of the sheep that Epimenides had had them go and make. It was really the Lamb of God. That was what he wanted them to see and understand. And so you can imagine that Paul must have realized, as he thought back, perhaps it was Gamaliel, his teacher, who had him go read all those classical Greek books. And he knew these tales, he knew these things about Greek history, and he was able to bring that up and use that to reason with the people here at this time. And it reminds us of how much God often uses the experiences that are in our lives in order for us to further his ministry, as well as appoint things throughout history that will come and be used by him. And that's what Paul was doing at this time. He was taking something that Epimenides had introduced them to, that is, a God they did not know and did not understand. And he, hundreds of years later, brought them to understand on that spot the identity of who that God was. And so the next couple of verses bring us to the end of the sermon, verse 32. And it says that simply that we will hear thee again on this matter, as the Athenians said. Probably the Epicureans who had mocked him earlier again said that they mocked him. They appeared to mock him at this time, as the verse says. And it was probably the Stoics who said, "We'll listen to you again." And the way the verse is written, the particular word for again has actually a conjunction in front of it that implies that they would just hear him over and over and over again, not just once again, but many times again, without any real consequence or significance to it. So they really didn't take it much to heart, what Paul had told them. Here were the keepers of the ancient culture of the world. Athens was immersed in culture and man-centered religions and human reason. It was part of an aging society surrounded by decline and overwhelmed by idols. And as we live in a world today, that's very much like the one described here. So I have just a few minutes for a conclusion, and I want to look at the last two verses of this story. If you look at verse 33 and 34, and the text tells us that it says, "So Paul departed from them, howbeit certain men clave unto him and believed, among the which was Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with them." There are three things that and I to this slide here. Three things that I wanted to show you to take away from this lesson, the story that we've seen in these two verses. Paul was departed, leaving this place, which reminds us that he probably only visited Athens once, from what we can tell. There's no evidence that indicates he came before or after. He didn't write any letters to them. He didn't mention them in any of the letters. There was no church started at this time that we can tell. And it makes you realize that there are many times in life that we pass by places and see things and people that we'll never see again. That's what this verse tells us here, that he left them and would perhaps never pass this way again. But for him, it was a place that he took very much notice of, paid attention to, took opportunities in, perhaps realizing that alone, being here and leaving never to be again, this was the one chance, this was the one opportunity that he had. And so if we live our lives with that mindset, aware that many of the people, many of the places that we pass during the times and the days we'll never visit again, it changes our perspective on our mission as disciples. The second thing to see from these verses is that it says in verse 34, others believed. Now, the way Luke put this, it appears to be one of the worst responses ever. This wasn't the way Luke usually described the results. In other places, he said many believed, multitudes believed. Here he just said some or others believed. So we get the impression that there were not a lot that believed. The results were not real obvious to Paul. He did not get to see the results that he would like to have seen. But we do know that Paul somehow got this story over to Luke. He was alone while he was here, so probably Luke got the story directly from Paul. And Luke probably took notes, got the story from him, and wrote it down for us to have today. And so when Paul wrote something, he wrote it with the emphasis and the details that were on his mind to tell Luke. And it was from that we have this story that lived far beyond Paul. For centuries later, others would read the story. Others would be converted and believe. Others would find it strengthening and encouraging. And so the result Paul never saw of his stop in Athens. He probably thought discouragingly and didn't accomplish much there. But we know better from having the story told and reread many times. The third thing I want to mention is that Paul obviously told Luke two people by name, two names that would be recorded forever in the text. We don't know a lot about them, but Paul took notice of them, and Luke recorded them. One was Dionysius the Areopagite. Now that tells us a little bit. Areopagite indicates he was probably a member of that 12-man council. He was probably an older man because he had to be a certain age to get on the council, and he was probably a prominent person, well-respected. Some believe he may have even eventually led a church here. And then there was a woman named Damaris. The text tells us that they clave to him. The word kaleo literally means to glue. It means they were glued together in friendship. So when Paul left Athens, he was no longer alone. He had a friendship. He had at least a couple of friends that he named, and a few others, perhaps, that were mentioned as well. And so the Lord provided him a personal blessing, perhaps to encourage him, perhaps to strengthen him, because he was about to set off on a hot, long road, about 45 miles long, to get to Corinth, this next stop. Silas and Timothy still hadn't caught up with him. Perhaps this is the thought and the joy that he carried with him as he left Athens, that there were a few new believers that were his friends, and that he could take those thoughts with him. So we should give attention to the places that we pass by, not expect results always to be within our sight, and find joy in the friendships along the way. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for another lesson, another journey, another stop that we can learn from. And I pray that you'll help us to remember some of the things that were told in the story that would help us on our mission, in our way, that would encourage and strengthen us, that would make us attentive to the things and places that we come across, knowing that you've appointed the times and the places, and that it is all set up to give us the opportunities of ministry. I pray that this week will be some of those times, and that as we go through the days, that we will notice the places we pass by and be ready with your message to share. In Jesus' name I pray, amen.